We're talking about the aftermath of Shopko as the 11 remaining Wisconsin stores closed for good Sunday night. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. And, you know, there was hope early on in the bankruptcy process that unprofitable stores would close and others would stay open through a new buyer. But then we heard back in March, Shopko announced its nearly six-decade run was ending, about 15,000 employees out of work. Did you work for Shopko? How are you feeling? Have you been able to find a new job? Has Shopko's closure left a void in your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. Jeff Bollier covers business in the Green Bay area as a reporter for Press Gazette Media. Jeff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me back.
So shoppers were snatching up those last-minute, last-hour deals, but a really sad day for employees of Shopko. What was that like? You know, what did you sense there?
Well, it was a very sad day all around. Definitely for the employees who were kind of toughing out a very rough last day, you know, on a job that some of them at the stores in Green Bay have had for, 30 years in some cases, one store manager told me. So this is hitting both the employees and the community hard. And, you know, I mean, the community members were really kind of doing amazing things for the workers. You know, I mean, people brought in bottled water and cookies and donuts for the employees to kind of just sneak a snack where they could and just to say thank you for serving them and taking care of them for years.
So walk us through the process of what led to this weekend's shuttering of all the stores. How did we get here?
Well, we got here. Shopko had kind of faced competition from all sides, the online sort of sphere of retail, but also dollar stores and big boxes up to Walmarts and Meijers. And so they kind of finally succumbed to this pressure and this competition from all sides, and they ended up filing for bankruptcy protection with a plan to try and reorganize and kind of keep some a core of stores open. Unfortunately, they couldn't find an investor for that, and as you mentioned in the intro, they had to kind of decide to make this painful decision to close all of the stores, more than 300 of them, as of last weekend.
And many of these communities relied on their Shopko for a lot of different services, optical, pharmacy. What does this mean for shopping options in communities that have lost their Shopko?
Well, you know, I mean, in Green Bay, we will have plenty, you know, we have many options and different varieties that we can choose from. But I did speak to a Green Bay resident who goes to school in River Falls, and she told me that, you know, in River Falls, Shopko was the only general merchandise retailer, pardon me, that was within the city limits and within an easy drive from the campus. And so, you know, it is going to impact smaller communities in a big way. They're going to be losing, as you said, in some cases, their only pharmacy option and or their only optical option also for eyewear and eye exams.
We're looking at the aftermath of Shopko as the last remaining stores closed this week in Wisconsin. Jeff Bollier covers business in the Green Bay area for USA Today Network Wisconsin, covered all the developments on Shopko's demise. Did you work for the company? What was it like? Were you laid off because of store closures? Have you found a new job? We're at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you to join in. So, Jeff, what happens to Shopko Optical and Pharmacy? Because I know there were reports that there were some bad deals that went down for how Shopko put these services together. What do we know there?
The optical business, there wasn't really a bad deal with the optical business. It was just a matter of finding a buyer who was interested in keeping it going. So while Shopko, the general retailer that we know and came to love here in Wisconsin, is kind of no more, its optical business has successfully been spun off and is moving into as many as 80 standalone optical centers. They're going to be smaller little storefronts in communities across their sort of old retail footprint. And if you did go to any of the stores over the weekend that do have an optical location, they had a lot of signs up that were kind of pointing out that the optical will be relocating but is not going anywhere.
And so there is that enough brand awareness and customer base for Shopko to spin off its optical.
Yeah, so, you know, much like it, you know, Shopko is very original or unique in kind of developing the pharmacy business in its general merchandise retail stores back in the 1960s when it opened. And so its optical business was kind of showing that same sort of repeat strength where it was doing good business. It was still a viable sort of operation. They just needed to find somebody who could invest in it and take it to its own sort of standalone business.
Okay, so what happened in pharmacy then?
In pharmacy, most of those assets, you know, customer lists and services for them were sold off in February, March, maybe a few in April. But those customers hopefully by now have heard from the pharmacies that have kind of taken over Shopko's operations in the different communities and are able to make sort of alternative arrangements by now.
So, meanwhile, the bankruptcy case continues. What's ahead for the legal situation here?
So there's, you know, sales and the going out of business liquidations have ended, but the business itself still has to kind of wind down its books. It still has, you know, some administrative claims to consultants and lawyers and other, involved parties to pay, and it has to settle as many of its debts as it can. Now, many of the debts to vendors will probably not be, you know, the vendors might get penny on the dollars, but most of the, you know, legal and operational claims should be paid.
What happens to the employees? There were 15,000 people laid off. That's a lot of workforce.
That is a lot of workforce. And just anecdotally, you know, my colleagues, you know, throughout the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, Sarah Rasner, Lydia Slattery, Megan Stringer, Caitlin Schuda, and Maureen Wallenfang, who all helped on this last day of Shopko story, all heard from people, various mix. Some have jobs lined up and had gracious employers who were willing to let them finish out their time at Shopko, while others were still looking and pursuing maybe job retraining and looking at new careers. So it is something that is going to take a while for the state to sort of absorb that workforce, and it will be interesting to see where they go and what they end up doing.
I wonder what happens to that corporate headquarters as well, that real estate.
It will be interesting to see. I've kind of had an eye on that and just was driving past that yesterday for an assignment. And there's still a few cars there and still some very basic operations going on there. But it is a large property in the village of Ashwaubenon that people are watching.
So as we wrap up, Jeff, you cover the ins and outs of business. What can other retailers learn from what happened to Shopko?
Well, you know, throughout the region that the USA Today Network covers, we did a little survey a few months back, and we found that, you know, Shopko's problem, if there was one with shoppers, was that they weren't known for anything specific. They weren't known for discounts, or they weren't known for having the best or the biggest variety of housewares or clothing or whatever. And so without a specialty, they kind of lost that connection with people where they sort of associate it with a product or a need. And that's what some people said. Others have said that not a major online presence didn't help them. So.
Well, Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Kate, thank you for having us.
Jeff Bollier covers business in the Green Bay area as a reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin. Up next, we consider what exactly is in our clothing and how it affects our health. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about chemicals in clothing here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And this conversation grew out of a lawsuit you may have heard about last month. Two Delta Airlines flight attendants alleged their Passport Plum uniforms produced by Lands' End caused health problems. And so in late 2016, Delta made a big to-do unveiling new uniforms in a runway show with its own employees modeling the looks and walking the catwalk.
On the runway, here's Scotty wearing the ACS version of our men's ground speed graphite suit. And Zakedra wearing the shared look in passport plum pants and vest.
Are there certain types of clothing that cause your skin to react? What do you do about it? And when you shop for clothes, what do you look for on the label? What material do you avoid? We're at 800-642-1234. Majid Sarmadi is a design studies professor at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, and he specializes in textile fibers, dyeing, finishing, and sustainability. He's consulted with dozens of brands on their materials. Majid, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Dr. Margot Reeder is a dermatologist at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Reeder, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Majid, you recently received funding to look at what's inside our garments. Can you tell us about that? What do you hope to accomplish with this funding?
This is a joint project with Dr. Margot Reeder. So what we received funding to see if there are formaldehyde on our clothes, is emitting from our clothes that causes skin reaction. So we do tests in our laboratory, and we find what it is and what level of formaldehyde, for example, or other chemicals. We started with formaldehyde, and we are going to look for other chemicals. We are isolating one chemical at the time. That's our plan. And then when we find the chemical, and we make different concentration for Dr. Margot Reeder, and she will test on the skin of people, on volunteers, and then she find the type of a reaction to those.
Mm. So you say formaldehyde. What is formaldehyde? Why is it in our clothes?
Formaldehyde is in our clothes in many different ways. In the past, most of the wrinkle-free fabrics were made from chemicals that they were bound to the fibers by formaldehyde, or after they decay, they would release formaldehyde. Therefore, that's the reason is there. It's one of the strong bonding agents that we have.
Oh, so it binds the fibers in such a way? And
with the chemicals that we want to put in it to make it wrinkle resistant.
Uh-huh.
And is in many, many other things, are in plastics, are in our cosmetics for many reasons. And it's you can find it sometimes even in drugs.
Dr. Reeder, I know you can't draw conclusions yet, but how have you seen people's skin react to formaldehyde and other chemicals?
So in textiles in particular, as Dr. Sarmadi mentioned, it can be used in the finishing of the fabric. So patients will often have dermatitis where clothing is tight against the skin, and that can be on the thighs or on the sides of the body. And the dermatitis tends to be worse in areas that are tightly fitted. So tightly fitted clothing or underlayers can cause contact allergy.
And Majid, how will the results of your data be used? You know, this is funding through the National Institutes of Health. You know, what are you trying to resolve here?
If we find how much of those chemicals are on the fabrics, and then Dr. Reeder finds out what level of allergy people are showing, we are hoping that by publishing the results and bring it to attention of a textile industry to lower the result of these chemicals on the fabrics. And also, Dr. Reeder will send the flyers and the results to other doctors presented in the dermatology conferences. And we know this is the reaction and how we do deal with it. So from two points, Dr. Reeder's, from doctors and dermatology and let the physician know. And we in a textile industry lobby for lowering some of those chemicals that be safer for the people that they are using it and also safer for the workers in the industry they are dealing with it.
We're talking about the chemicals in clothes and what goes into garments during the manufacturing process. Majid Sarmadi is a professor of design studies at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Dr. Margot Reeder is here. She's a dermatologist at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Do you make or sell clothes that are clear of certain chemicals or dyes? Which ones do you avoid? How do you, as a consumer, try to encourage manufacturers to make different choices on clothing fibers and chemical processes? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Earlier, we heard Delta Airlines, Dr. Reeder, flight attendants say their Lands' End uniforms give them skin rashes, headaches, fatigue, even low white blood cell count. Have you seen patients react to clothing in this way before?
I have seen patients develop dermatitis from clothing, and there are a couple different types of reaction you can get from clothing. I specialize in contact dermatitis, and there are two different types of contact dermatitis. There's allergic reactions, which tend to be specific and related to the immune system reacting to clothing. And then there's irritant contact dermatitis, which can often be caused by the nature of the textile, whether it's a rough fabric. And so we see both of those, and patients can develop itchy rashes where skin clothing is tight. And to diagnose this, we do something called patch testing, which is a type of skin allergy testing, where we test patients to a variety of different chemicals that can be found in clothing, and that can include textile dyes, but also finishing resins.
Oh, so you do just a patch to see, you know, the difference between, okay, on this part of the skin, this happened, and on, you know, the adjacent skin, it didn't happen.
Actually, patch testing is a test that we perform typically on the skin on the back. And it's different than skin prick testing, which is a type of allergy testing that lots of people are familiar with. Skin prick testing tests for things like cats or dust or dander, but contact dermatitis is diagnosed by patch testing, which is testing for chemicals that can be not just in clothing, but also things that can be in personal care products like soaps or lotions or sunscreens. We see patients that can develop allergies to these things that they come into contact with frequently.
So are there certain chemicals that seem to be a culprit more than others for patients? Are there certain chemicals that come up in terms of issues?
Sometimes preservatives can be something we see. So preservatives are often added to personal care products to prevent things from going bad. You don't want to open your shampoo and see bacteria. So we need preservatives, but those can sometimes be a source of allergy. Metals is another common reaction. So patients who might develop rashes from jewelry, earrings, that can be related to metals. And what we really wanted to investigate was formaldehyde, which can also be found in personal care products as preservatives.
Well, let's take a call now. Diane is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Hi, good morning. And thank you for your work. I appreciate this. I am very sensitive to chemicals in the fabrics that I wear, and I found that silk is one of the fabrics that I can trust more than any other, and I was wondering if you found that. And the second is, what is mummy weight in silk? I know it's the weight, but if you could describe it, and is there a relationship to the weight of the fabric with chemical content?
Diane, thank you for those questions. Majid, can you take it?
Yes, there are two type of silk that they are in the market. Raw silk that has not been processed. When the silkworm is secreting the fiber, it comes from two nozzles and they are in a waxy material. Raw silk is processed with those waxy material and they show no reaction at the at least to our best of knowledge to human skin and those things. But there are those washable silk. Stay away from the washable silk. Because washable silk, the gum has been removed, and then because the fiber, we don't want it to stay limp, we add chemicals to it. These chemicals are from heavy metals all the way to plastics, such as we embed them in nylon or polyester film. Therefore, washable silk, you can wash it without any problem, but you know, that's a problem.
We're getting a better sense of what is in our fibers with Majid Sarmadi. He is a professor of design studies at UW-Madison. Dermatologist Margot Reeder is here from UW-Madison School of Medicine Public Health. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a news update right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the synthetic chemicals used in manufacturing clothes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. These additives may keep clothes stain-resistant or wrinkle-free, and this conversation comes on the heels of a lawsuit brought last month by a couple of Delta flight attendants who alleged negligence by Land's End, who made their uniforms. And Delta, by the way, said this month it's releasing new untreated uniforms for employees who have been affected. Some employees have been allowed to wear their black and white uniform instead of the standard uniform with a doctor's note. So are there certain types of clothing that cause your skin to break out? Have you dealt with it? When you shop for clothes, are there materials you make sure to avoid? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Majid Sarmadi is a UW-Madison Design Studies professor specializing in textile fibers and dyeing and finishing. Dr. Margot Reeder is here. She's a dermatologist at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Let's go to the phones now with Mo joining us from Oconto. Hi, Mo.
Hi. Don't know if this was asked before or not, but you have stain resistance like Teflon added to clothing, and also you'll have Gore-Tex in different types of clothing. Are there any endocrine disruptors or effects on the skin from these products?
Dr. Reeder, I'll have you start with that.
I'm actually going to have Dr. Sarmadi answer that question.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
She always gives me the hard ones. I don't know about endocrine disruptors, but remember one rule. Anytime that you put a chemical against your skin, since skin is largest organ, you got to be careful. We as consumer want many different properties from our fibers and from our fabrics that they don't have it naturally. So we want them to make it in a way that they don't wrinkle, they don't catch fire. We want to make our garments do not smell, and we want to have lots of things, water resistance, waterproof.
We want it all.
You name it. And the more of these labels that you are seeing, it shows there are more chemicals on the fabrics. So sometimes a fabric has 3, 4, 5 different chemicals to give you a few resistance that you want or properties. And that's the case with Delta Airline uniforms. They have so many different properties for that only achieve by adding chemicals.
And as Mo was saying, you know, we wear Gore-Tex underneath, you know, layers right against the skin to have that wicking, you know, keeping sweat away from the skin. That certainly has to have some more high-tech nature to it, and chemicals are in the mix.
Yes, but remember that we shouldn't ban all of these things. We should label them that people know what is in them. For example, peanut butter, everybody enjoys it, but there are certain people that they have allergy to it. So I don't want to say, okay, textile industry have to stop producing all of these things, but it's labeled in a way that you can see. So anytime that you see all of these properties that says, okay, it wicks, you know, moisture, or is wrinkle resistant, stain resistant, or this resistance or that, you got to say, okay, am I one of those people have a sensitive skin? Am I the person that has to stay with 100% cotton? Then I have to iron it. I have to press it. You know, there is lots of those things that we don't have time for them these days.
Yeah, cotton is so wonderful, but it does wrinkle.
Wrinkle very badly.
Yeah.
Remember in the old times, people wash one day and two days ironing
yeah.
or pressing them.
Uh-huh.
You know, but we don't have time for it anymore.
Mo, do you look at labels very closely?
I try to, especially in like... skincare products, things like that.
Yeah.
Not as far as the clothing, because it is what it is, but I kind of try to avoid the Teflon stain resistance in clothes if I can.
Dr. Reeder, do you suggest people look closely at labels?
I think it's important to look at the clothing to know what the fabric content is. That can be helpful for people, particularly if they have allergies to either dyes or resins in clothing. A lot of the information they get of how to avoid that comes from actually the type of fabric, because different dyes are used for different types of fabric. For example, dyes that are used in cotton fabric are different than those that are used in polyester and other synthetic fabrics.
Let's go to Jerry now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You are talking right down the line of labeling, and that was kind of my concern. And my question is that, you know, it took a lot of legislation, especially in our country, to get fairly proper labels as to what's in our food. And is there any work or any, you know, thinking towards revealing what's in our clothing?
Majid?
Well, there are some labeling. When you are seeing that cotton fabric is waterproofed or cotton fabric that has been wrinkle resistant or dollar press or wash and wear, those are the labels that we put on them. Adding big name of the chemicals or list of them is cumbersome, and you can't do that, and people do not what does it mean. But we are communicate with our customers with those labels. So when you see it, that's your label.
Let's go to Christina now, joining us from Glenwood City. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. For tick protection, we are advised to spray clothing with pimethrin 24 hours before wearing. Is it safe to wear this clothing next to the skin after the 24 hours, or should we wear another layer next to the body?
Great question. Dr. Reeder, do you have any insights there?
Permethrin is something that's commonly used. It can be used to prevent bug bites, too, and we often spray it on the outerwear of the clothing. The best thing for tick protection is actually being really diligent about long sleeves and pants, making sure that that your socks are tightly against the skin so that ticks can't crawl up and bite you. And so I think that a lot of these chemicals, like permethrin in particular, will stay on the clothing for a couple washes. I think that it's a good spray for the outerwear.
We are looking at the processes that clothes go through as they are made and how those chemical exposures may impact our health. Majid Sarmadi researches this. He's a professor of design studies at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Dr. Margot Reeder is a dermatologist. She's here as well. When you shop for clothes, what do you look for on the tag? What do you avoid? Do you make or sell clothes that steer clear of certain chemicals or dyes? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to the phones with Nan joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Nan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a comment and a question specific to formaldehyde. I treated in the early 90s that did my children with an environmental allergist who was using skin prick for chemicals, and formalin, formaldehyde was one of them. It caused extreme contact dermatitis and itching, but we also had reactions to breathing in the fumes. So for the contact dermatitis, we got rid of all permanent press clothing, we got rid of dryer sheets, and we got rid of laundry detergent and fabric softeners that listed formaldehyde. As far as other things, formaldehyde is in paint. It is in pressed boards. You know, so if you buy a piece of furniture, that's less expensive and it has pressed board in it. And those items, we had to outgas the room for a few days before it was safe for us to go back in. So my question is, why were they able to use skin prick in the 90s and now switch to patch? And just to comment that if you have a reaction to skin contact formaldehyde, you may very well also have a reaction to other items that it is in.
Hmm. Dr. Reeder.
That's a great point about the other exposures of formaldehyde. I often see formaldehyde in personal care products not listed as formaldehyde, but actually as other chemicals under the title of formaldehyde-releasing preservatives. So they're preservatives that are in things like soaps, lotions, sunscreens, shampoos that don't list formaldehyde specifically, but they're chemicals that lead to the release of formaldehyde, and there are several of those. You bring up a lot of other really important exposures that we do see some patients react to, things like industrial chemicals or paints can contain formaldehyde, and that's exactly right. Things like wood can also off-gas and release formaldehyde. I'm not sure about the prick testing for the formaldehyde. We typically diagnose these patients by doing patch tests to low concentrations of formaldehyde.
Majid, you know, often you hear that you should just wash your clothes before you wear them. After you purchase the clothing, wash before wear. Can that help in any way with the impact of what is in the clothing?
Actually, yes, it's some, not totally. And that's one of the things that we are establishing with our research, that how much formaldehyde, for example, is decreased or increased by washing.
Oh.
By washing. So we are following that one. So we are washing the clothes up to 10 times, and then we are seeing what has happened to the release of formaldehyde from wash and wear clothing. And that's what we are trying to establish. We are not ready to release all of our data yet, but we will soon, within few months. And we are also looking at social justice aspect of that.
We're talking about chemical processes in clothing, and we'll be right back here on the Ideas Network. We're taking a closer look at chemicals in clothing here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Majid Sarmadi is a professor of design studies at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Dr. Margot Reeder is a dermatologist at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. They stay with us. Majid, before we went to our break there, you were talking about the impact of social justice. What do we know there in terms of chemicals and processes in clothing manufacturing?
Dr. Reeder and I decided that we are going to test fabrics and garments of different pricing to see, for example, if we find lower price item have more problem or cheaper chemicals have been used on them versus the high price items. So we have bought, for example, shirts that we bought about $120 to test versus the shirt that was $10. So, and the range of them to look at the social justice point of view. And we are testing them. We are in the process of analyzing all of these garments. The same thing on women clothing we have done by high price versus low price items. So And whenever we are ready, we have the results, then we can have another show and talk about those results.
So take us into your lab for a moment. When you have this shirt and it costs, whether it's high-end or low-end, $120 or $10, what do you do with that shirt when you go into your lab?
Okay. We cut multiple pieces off that shirt.
Oh, you cut up the shirt.
They cut up the shirt.
Okay.
And then we analyze through analytical methods and using a spectrophotometer to measure and using chemical, and we do titration and we extract the chemicals out of it. And then we analyze those chemicals. So one test, it takes about 24 hours, just to get one result. These are time-consuming that we are doing. We have a standard test method that and procedures that we have to follow. We bake them in oven to certain temperatures and certain level of humidity and certain things to see what chemical is releases, and we analyze.
Oh, those. That might even resemble what happens in our dryer.
Yes. You know, in dryers, in washing, in many different cases, what will happen? And then when you are wearing it, you know, and your skin is wet and your sweat is there, and then it's hot and humid outside, 100 degree, 90 degree. So we got to look at many different scenarios.
And then when do your results go over to Dr. Reeder? What happens there?
So my part of this project is looking at patients who have known allergies to formaldehyde and seeing at what concentrations do they react to the formaldehyde. So we're currently recruiting patients who have allergies to formaldehyde to the dermatology clinic for patch testing to low concentrations of formaldehyde, with the idea that potentially there could be a threshold at which patients no longer react to very low concentrations of formaldehyde.
Majid, you've been studying clothes and fibers for a very long time. What do you find that has changed in the industry for better or for worse over the decades?
Well, there has been lots of changes. In the past, we were buying not many clothes, you know, lower number of items, but they were higher quality. And there was not as many chemicals on them. Now we are buying lower price items. We call it fast fashion. And you want something for one season or two season, and then you want something different. Therefore, the price of the item is lower. The quality has to be lower in order to be affordable by a larger group of people. So there has been some changes.
You work with many different brands. Do you find that there is pressure within the industry to do better, to really pay attention to these chemicals and what they're doing to people?
Actually, not only brands, but the textile industry as a whole is always strive to make them better, to make safer chemicals, because it's in their interest to have a safer chemical on those things. But it's a rat race. You always do, and with the best knowledge that you have, and the chemical till you see somebody shows reaction to this particular chemical. So you find something that is much safer. But as I said, many natural products people are allergic to. And therefore, you know,
you're caught.
Yeah.
Well, Majid, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Majid Sarmadi is a professor of design studies at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, researching textile fibers, dyeing, finishing, and sustainability. Dr. Reeder, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Margot Reeder is a dermatologist at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, specializing in contact dermatitis and patch testing.
Jacqueline Hernandez knew she wanted to help people.
When I was in high school, I would volunteer in hospitals. So it's been my thing.
Hernandez is 22. She's from Milwaukee. She started college but dropped out. For a while, she worked at a retail job that she didn't like.
My life was just in a big pause.
Applying at the Blackwell Job Corps Center was her way to get unstuck. She enrolled in the federal job training program for disadvantaged young people and in January started courses at the center in Leona. Hernandez is now 6 months into a program that would make her a certified nursing assistant.
It was like, okay, another door, you know, an opportunity. So I like to say it was like the light at the end of my tunnel.
For a while, it seemed like she would lose the opportunity. Over Memorial Day weekend, the Trump administration announced plans to close or privatize the nation's job centers, laying off more than 1,000 federal workers and shuttering the 55-year-old Blackwell facility. It would have forced Hernandez and about 70 other young people to leave the program or transfer elsewhere. Those plans met with bipartisan opposition in Congress, and on Wednesday, the Trump administration announced that the center will stay open after all. On a tour of the Northwoods Center, Hernandez and other students talked about what Blackwell means to them.
Over here we have our welders.
Andrew Jameson Duncan is 22 and in the campus's welding program. He's from Minnesota. Before he came to Blackwell, he had been homeless for 8 months and sleeping in the woods.
Police came, got me, gave me a brochure for this place, and I came over here because it was the best thing for me.
Another welding student, Alberto Romero from Beloit, said he learned about the program in the Wisconsin National Guard Challenge Academy.
To me, it was like heaven. I wanted to come here.
The next stop on Hernandez's tour is a computer lab.
Here, go ahead.
Students are studying for their high school equivalency diplomas. Some students, like Hernandez, have graduated by the time they come to Blackwell. But the center also takes students as young as 16 who haven't finished high school. TJ Cole is 17. He's from central Wisconsin, about an hour and a half away from the site. He was never great in school, he said, and he came to Blackwell after his vice principal recommended it.
You know, at first I was a bit hesitant to come over here for like the first couple of months, but eventually once you get used to the people, you know, you find out this is an awesome program with amazing people, staff, and students overall, and I'm so glad I came here.
Christy Caudell is president of a federal workers union representing Blackwell employees. She was at the center when the news broke that the Trump administration would keep Blackwell open. She said organization made the difference.
We banded together across all of the CCCs across the nation, along with the community members, the forestry, and the congressmen stepping up and saying, this can't be done. It will be detrimental to these communities.
For Hernandez, the weeks of uncertainty were hard. She felt like her life had been put back on pause. Reached by phone not long after she learned that Blackwell would stay open, she said things were back on track. And she's not the only one who feels that way.
I've actually had a couple conversations with, like, you know, students and with me and my trade. And they're like, okay, I can finally get back on what I was doing. I can finally do what I want, what I came here for, you know?
Caudell said the fight to protect Job Corps isn't over. Her group plans to push for a law that would require Congress to approve any closures instead of leaving it up to the discretion of cabinet secretaries. For today's Blackwell students, though, the news means they can get back to their courses, get their certifications, find a job and a trade. After all, that's what they went there to do. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And Rob Menser there reporting on the Blackwell Job Corps Center. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.